We're happy to make podcasts available for selected EdWebinars for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.
Welcome to everyone. It's been fun seeing where you're joining in from all over the United States and across the globe. Thank you so much. Welcome to this webinar on individualized learning. If you want to learn more about Renaissance, Jean and I encourage you to visit renaissance.com or to call the number on your screen. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce my dear friend and colleague, Dr. Jean Kearns, Vice President and Chief Academic Officer of Renaissance. Jean, we're all excited to hear what you have to tell us about individualized assessment. Individualized learning.
Thank you, Jan. And as Jan noted, there is that chat button or chat area on the side. So folks are going to be monitoring that one to direct as many questions or answer as many of them as they can on the fly, and then also saving up questions for the end. So if a question pops to mind, please go ahead and enter it in the chat section, and we will use that to address as many questions as time would permit. So our topic today is individualized learning and attempting to sort of cut through the confusion about all that, because there's a lot swirling in terms of school reform, and we're hearing lots of conversations about individualized learning and personalized learning. And so we want to sort of cut through some of the confusion today and hopefully get some clarity. Now, I want to start at what I would call the 40,000 foot level. And for those of you that fly often, you know, that's kind of a high level. Usually you're flying at, you know, 29, 30, maybe 35,000. So when I say let's start at a 40,000 foot level, I'm talking about let's start at a broader idea, and we'll fly up there a little bit, and then we'll zoom in a little bit closer to really the topic that we're dealing with, because individualized learning, to truly understand it, puts it in a little bit larger context. Now, I also want to frame this by saying that this currently, right now, for our profession, is very much of a debate or a discussion. Definitions around individualized learning, there's no common accepted one. Ways to do it vary immensely, and the same is the case with personalized learning. So right now, it's almost difficult to assume that someone might be an expert to impart knowledge. It's more about beginning the dialogue and helping all of us think about what this might mean for us. So I want to hit a couple of really high-level ideas as we make our way through. And the first one is the idea that there's a really important link that occurs between individualized learning and personalized learning. And for those of you that are in a position like mine and you get emails about education news, probably a day doesn't go by that you don't see something about personalized learning. So I want to point out a couple things that are really, really massive shifts that are occurring. First of all, Facebook's founder, Mark Zuckerberg, has put about $500 million behind the development of technology to support personalized learning. So tremendous investment there. Another area of investment is coming also from technology, coming from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. If you go to their website, you take a look at the things that they are promoting, you will find personalized learning. And again, we're at 40,000 foot personalized. We're going to go back down to individualized in a minute. But at the 40,000 foot level, Bill and Melinda Gates are also backing personalized learning. So just between those two groups alone, you've probably got roughly about $750 million going into the development of technology to support personalized learning at scale. So a lot of money there. And again, hardly a day passes that we don't get an article about personalized learning. But it's not just in the literature and in these discussions, it's popping up in other places. For example, our new federal legislation, the Every Student Succeed Acts, or ESSA. That includes some references to some elements of personalized learning and actually some really good connections to individualized learning. And because of these policy discussions, it's beginning to precipitate state-level initiatives. So for those of you following personalized learning in particular, the state of Rhode Island is doing a lot of work there and actually just launched a statewide initiative to probably bring personalized learning to the largest scale we've ever seen. So I wanted to bring up, we've got all these terms that kind of swirl around, and sometimes definitions aren't really clear. And so we can't drill into a topic until we're actually clear that each of us is talking about the same thing. And in my mind, I think the three terms you see on the screen are probably some of the most muddled terms in education right now. Differentiation, individualization, personalization. A lot of people treat these as if they were almost synonyms, and there are some important differences here. So if you start reading about either individualized learning or personalized learning, you'll probably have the experience that I had. And that is, you pick up a couple of articles, and the next thing you know, you're not just talking about individualization or personalization. Then there's all these references to competency and mastery and blended learning and flipped classrooms. And the way I present it, or the way that I talk about it, is often these conversations take on a feeling of the kitchen sink. You remember that phrase, everything but the kitchen sink? And a lot of times right now, when you start reading about personalized learning or individualized learning, all of these other terms come along for the ride. And so in training with teachers, and we don't have really the time to do this today, but this is something I encourage you, those of you who are school leaders, to think about. These terms that you see up on the board, put this slide up or some variation of that, and ask the following question to the people in the room. What do these terms mean? How are they related? Or maybe even potentially synonymous? They mean the same thing. Or how are they different? And to generate a little bit of conversation, sometimes I'll also say to audiences, if you were to take these terms, if you could touch the screen and move them around to regroup them and help you find better meaning or make better sense of them, what is it that you would do? So that we can have this conversation, I'll put the terms back up. Again, look at the words you see on the screen. What do they mean? Are some of these terms related or potentially synonymous? Are they different? And if you could rearrange them, what would you do to help yourself make meaning? Well, let me show you what most people end up doing with this collection when they are in a live setting. I often get groups that say, if I were to rearrange it, it would look something like this. I would clump differentiation, individualization, and personalization all together because I see them as being very related. I'm not really sure about how to draw the lines, but I see them as being cut from the same cloth. And then I'll put the other ones together because they somehow seem different. And if I start trying to tease out for them, well, what are these differences? And really, why did you group like this? They will often say, it seems like differentiation, individualization, personalization, that's what we're trying to do. And then the other things that you saw up there, the blended learning and the flipped classroom, those are how we're going about doing it. In other words, we might use a flipped classroom model to help achieve more personalization or individualization. At the heart of it, though, is still a problem we've got to resolve, and this is the first outcome from today. I want a good working definition for personalized learning because individualization is part of that, and the ability to draw the lines between these. Because when I go back to this idea that many people will clump differentiation right next to individualization and personalization, when I ask them more about that, they will often say, you know, I think these are all related, but my guess is that individualization and personalization are more intense. And here's why I think that. They say, I think that because differentiation is not new. We've been talking about that for 15 or 20 years in education. But conversations around personalization and individualization, they are new. And so usually most people will say, I don't know what the differences are, but I feel really comfortable in saying that personalization and individualization must be somehow more intense. So before I sort of fill in the blanks and help you draw the lines between that, that brings us to our first poll question. So Ed Webb, let's go ahead and run the first poll. I'd like to get a little bit of feedback from you all as an audience. This vocabulary dilemma that we have of telling the difference between individualization, differentiation, personalization, how comfortable do you feel about that? Do you say, I'm very comfortable in doing that? Or do you say that I am somewhat comfortable in doing that? Or do you say, you know what, I'm not really all that comfortable at all? Now, in good teaching mode, as a teacher, I'll use this data to decide where we're going to go and how long we'll dwell on each of these ideas. But knowing that many of you are active members in the EdWeb community and seeing a variety of these webinars, I just want to make sure I wasn't dealing with a painfully obvious. So I'm taking a look at these results here, and we're going to go ahead and stop voting in just a minute because I think we've had enough people submit returns. Basically, what I see is this large mountain. I see 68% of people say, I'm only somewhat comfortable in delineating between these terms. Only 10% said they were very comfortable. And another 21%, oops, just changed a little bit. Anyhow, a total of 90% then saying only somewhat or not at all comfortable in delineating between these terms. So our first lesson to take care of, or our first piece of content to cover, is to get our vocabulary just right. So again, we're flying at 40,000 feet. We're going to get down to the individualization level, but I want to start up at the 40,000 foot level, which is where the dialogue is around personalized learning. If you haven't already gotten a definition for that, and that's, again, that's one of the problems, is we haven't gelled on a consistent definition. I want to hold up the one that I've been using. There are a lot of definitions out there that come from technology companies, and, you know, in all fairness, I work for one. However, I think there's some kind of bias when a technology company gives you a definition, and sometimes they talk about technology's role in that initiative. That's almost like the fox in the hen house. So when I was looking for a definition to base my work in this area on, I saw it in a nonpartisan group, if you will. So the definition I'm showing you for personalized learning comes from the U.S. Department of Education. So for those of you in the U.S., the extent to which that you align your work and build your response to these initiatives, personalized learning and individualization, the extent to which you align your work to this definition, it's going to kind of help you out as you work towards federal grants, because you're going to be talking about it the way that they talk about it. So let's work through this definition very quickly. First of all, I want you to look for two things that are going to change, because the definition begins by saying, educators, you're going to have to change two things to personalize education for kids. And it builds by saying this: personalized learning is referring to instruction in which the pace of learning — there's our topic for today, individualization — the pace of learning and the instructional approach. So there's your two things. Change the pace of your learning, change the approach that you are using with students. Now, if we're going to make a change is always uncomfortable. So we want to know why we're making the change and how we're going to know whether we're successful. And so the definition continues by saying, so that things are optimized for the needs of each learner. In other words, keep on adjusting the pace until it's optimal for each kid. Keep on adjusting the approach until it's optimal for each kid. That's the essence of personalized learning, okay? So when we go back to this vocabulary conundrum of differentiation in comparison with individualization and personalization, here's what we see. When someone says differentiation, they're talking about changing the approach. When someone says individualization, even though the term is not as intuitive as we would hope, when you read in the literature about individualization, that is the change the pace piece. So personalization then encompasses both of these things, okay? So personalization is changing the pace and changing the approach. Now, don't even try to read this slide I just put up until I give you a little bit of context, because there's way too many words. I wanted to drill just a little bit deeper. Let me go back for just a second. I want to drill down just a little bit into individualization for a second. Okay. And I want to offer for you some criteria or some discussions around individualization. If you get out there and you start reading all the literature on that, you will very quickly bump into this. I use the word definition, but it's almost like a list of qualities of competency-based learning, which I believe is synonymous with individualization. Okay. And the source for this is Patrick and Sturgis, 2011. So there was a massive conference on competency-based learning, individualization, and Patrick and Sturgis were invited to write the summary paper for that conference. And basically what you find is almost every journal, every article, every scholarly discussion that there has been since that conference goes back and cites this definition by Patrick and Sturgis. And they have some qualities here. We don't have time to deal with all of them, but I want to highlight the essence of all of this for you. So when someone's talking about individualized learning, it has to do primarily, or the heart of it is the line that I just shaded there, that students advance upon demonstrated mastery. So when they get it, they move ahead. But the flip side of that very same coin is, and they don't move ahead until they get it. Okay, so we're going to come back and deal into this because this is a game changer for us in the profession. But again, let's wrap up the 40,000 foot level so we can take the plane down to the individualization level. Let's get back to this definition, okay? Because the USDOE said personalized learning is when you're changing the approach, differentiation, when you're changing the pace, individualization. So personalized learning then encompasses both of these things, and there actually is one more element. This definition actually contains three elements, and we've seen two of them. So let's get that third element, just so you have the entirety of the definition. The definition continues by saying, in addition to changing the approach and changing the pace, work towards learning activities that are meaningful and relevant to learners, that are driven by their interests and are sometimes even self-initiated. And the label that most people are giving this type of discussion or this type of effort is to call it student agency. In other words, to make students or allow students to become active agents in their own learning. So at the end of it, what we see from this definition is personalized learning is three parts: change the approach, differentiation, change the pace, individualization, and work towards involving kids as agents in their own learning, their student agency. So for those of you that like to think visually, a triple Venn diagram, which you see on the screen, is a really good sort of visual to have in your mind. And where you see that arrow going to the very center of all three points, per this definition, that's where personalized learning would be. But our conversation today is about individualization. And that brings us to our second poll question for today. Individualized learning, helping kids moving ahead or helping them to move ahead at their own pace. How long has that been around? So for those of you that are experts in educational history, this is up your alley. What I want to know is, what was the earliest attempt in the United States to personalize or individualize education? Was it Lev Vygotsky's work around zone of proximal development? What was it the program called Democracy in Education, which was the first conversation about taking a child-centered approach? Was it IDEA, the Individual with Disabilities Education Act, which required for the first time individualized plans for students? Was it the Pueblo Plan, which allowed students to progress at their own pace? Or was it workaround mastery that occurred in the San Francisco Normal School? So you've got a bunch of choices there. You can only do one. We'll give you a couple more seconds to chime in and cast a vote there. My guess is many of you may, in some cases, be shying away that San Francisco Normal School one, because it's been a number of years since we called our colleges of education normal schools. So that probably dated just a little bit. It seems that IDEA is a really, really popular one, because I see 52% of you there. And the reality of it is that IDEA is not been around all that terribly long when we look at the larger sense of educational history. And we see a lot of folks, about 20%, clustering on Vygotsky's zone of proximal development. So we're going to go ahead and stop the poll. And if we didn't point this out before, I should have. You will need to close the poll yourself. So if it's hovering over your screen, go ahead and hit the little X in the top right corner there. But basically, the poll revealed that most people are saying, I think it started with IDEA. And the second most popular choice is to say that it started with Vygotsky. And you know what? I guess we kind of got you on that one. IDEA is actually the newest thing on the list, 1990 for that. And the second newest thing was Vygotsky's work on zone of proximal development, which was older than 1978, but really didn't hit the shores of the U.S. until roughly then. The reality of it is that students moving at their own pace began with the Pueblo Plan all the way back in 1898. So even though we're online today talking about individualized learning and letting kids move ahead at their own pace, those conversations are now some 100 and nearly 19 years old. And we need to acknowledge something about many of these approaches. Often, particularly when we look at, for example, Democracy in Education from 1916, the Pueblo Plan and the work that the San Francisco Normal School did on mastery, often what you see when you study the history of these programs is they weren't scalable and they weren't sustainable. So we've been trying to personalize learning and we've been trying to individualize learning, but it's always been hard to scale up and sustain over time? So a very legitimate question to ask ourselves today is, so what's changed? If somebody couldn't do it 117 years ago, what's changed for today? And there's a very clear answer, and that answer is technology. So basically, people are hoping that we are learning to use technology in ways that will allow us to personalize things more and individualize things more so that we can achieve both scale and sustainability there. And of all the conversations around personalization and individualization, I think there's more agreement around this point that it's going to take technology than maybe anything else. So again, back to Patrick and Sturgis in here, we see their description of what competency-based learning or individualization, changing the pace, what that would look like. An important question to ask ourselves is, if this is the new thing that we want kids to move ahead based on demonstrated mastery, as highlighted in this slide, if this is the new thing, competency or mastery, what was the old approach that we were taking? Because the reality is we're being asked to make a massive change in the way that we organize ourselves and operationalize school. So if this is the new approach, competency and mastery, what was the old approach? And I think one way to think about it is, in many ways, our old approach was a course count, Carnegie unit, or seat time type of thing. In other words, it takes X number of math credits to receive a diploma from the state. So to get a credit, you spend 180 days in a class called geometry, and you earn a D or better, and you receive a credit. Here's an interesting thing about the older approach. First of all, time was fixed. It didn't change. You had 180 days to be in geometry, whether you got through all of it or you got through very little of it. Also, too, there's this interesting dynamic that a student who got a D got a credit, and a student who got an A got a full credit. So it's kind of like for enduring the seat time, you get a credit and you get a credit and you get a credit. But all of us as educators would realize that if you got an A in the course, you probably mastered a whole lot more than you got a D. And often too, when we analyze grades, we find very little correlation between teachers' grades and students' overall performance or ability. Sometimes grades are a factor of behavior and how polite you are. And so it's kind of like if I'm a hardworking kid and I try, even if I don't master much, I'll probably get a D. Now, if I'm a kid that doesn't try and have a bad attitude, that's when I might get an F. But our grades and all these rankings, our conversation was more about behavior and time in seats as opposed to kids actually mastering the content of the course. So when Patrick and Sturgis say that individualized learning or competency-based education is about students advancing upon demonstrated mastery, that is a fundamental shift for us to understand. And that brings us to poll question number three, because to say that students advance upon demonstrated mastery means that the course counts and the Carnegie units and the seat time goes out the window. And for any of you that work in a high school and even some of you in middle schools where you're also granting credits, if a student enrolls, for example, early in a language course or in an algebra course, you're granting credits too. So an important question is, can we even do this in terms of regulation? So I want to ask the audience, do you know where your state stands in relation to this? Answer yes, if you know that in your state you can grant credits now based on mastery instead of seat time. Answer no if you say, no, I know we can't do that. And answer I don't know if you say, I really don't know if we can or if we can't. So again, we'll give a couple seconds more for folks to kind of respond to this. And generally, you know, the way the election's going right now with the polling precincts reporting, I see about 70% of you say, I don't know if we can do this. And, you know, that's an essential question for us to answer. Why are we here? Why are we talking about letting kids move ahead at their own pace if we can't grant them a credit by looking at their mastery as opposed to having them do the seat time in the course? So we see the results there. And basically, a lot of you say, you know what? I don't know whether we can or whether we can't. So let's get the answer as much as we possibly can by taking a look at the following map here. Now, the source for this is INACOL, the International, and I won't get their acronym just right, but the International Association for Online Learning. And they do a lot of work in this area. So if you're looking for some white papers and things to follow, they're a really good site to go to. But let's interpret the chart that you're seeing here. If your state is colored by the rust color, what it's saying is that's an advanced state. Not only is policy in place that you can move a kid's head based on mastery, not only is that policy in place, but there's a cadre of people at the state who can come to your school and district and help you with it. If your state's represented by green, the policy's there. The department may not have a team they can send to your school, but if you can figure out your own mastery model at your school level, policy's not gonna get in your way. The yellow states are emerging, they're building this. So the policy is near finished, it's begun. If you see shades or stripes in a state, it's that the state is partnering with others to do this work through the Council of Chief State School Officers. So that only leaves about five states by my count that are represented by solid white. Those are the states where no work has begun, no policy is here. So the reality of it is in 45 out of the 50 states, there's either policy in place or on the horizon. And earlier I mentioned the Every Student Succeeds Act. One of the important elements that's in that act is conversations that are supportive to competency-based mastery individualization models. So if you're in one of the states where it's not there, it's probably going to be there really quickly because educational requirements and funding from the federal level are there if your state puts the policy in place. So even though granting credit through mastery is something relatively new for us, this is actually a case where the policy's there. Many of you can do this if you can figure out the work necessary at the school level to make this work. So I want to highlight this citation by Michael Horn. And he said, you know what, let's think about how logical it is to give credit to kids, not based on their seat time, but based on them actually mastering these things. He says, look at the difference here. He says the older model actually mandated seat time. And many of you who are administrators, you know this. We have to document how many hours, how many days, how many minutes kids were there. That's how it all added up. And so in short, Horn is saying the old model emphasized or mandated seat time, but not necessarily mastery. Because you did the seat time, you got a D. You didn't master much geometry, but you got the credit. The new model says, no, it's not about seat time. It's not about how long a kid takes to do this. It's about them actually demonstrating mastery, showing us that they know how to do the necessary outcomes of a given course or content area for us to say, yeah, they've met the requirements. This is a fundamental shift because schools have always been organized around the seat time, course count, Carnegie unit model. So it's a big shift, huge change, lots of implications about what we do daily and how we run and how we work. And so if we're being asked to make such a huge shift, it better well be worth it. So I want to hold up a video that probably many of you have already seen. And if you have, if you're like me, you've probably gone back and watched it again and again and again. And if you haven't seen the next video, then I really hold it up to you as something you should watch. I think it asks some really important questions and challenges us as educators to think about things differently. And that is a TED Talk that was done by Sal Khan, the founder of Khan Academy. And basically what he says in the title here, let's quit trying to teach for the test, work towards our accountability and stuff. Let's actually teach for mastery. Let's teach in a way that kids get it. So I want to play just a short clip of this for you, for those of you that haven't seen it, just to sort of advance our thinking here. So EdWeb, if you'll help us by rolling that video clip.
In the traditional academic model, we group students together, usually by age and around middle school age and perceived ability, and we shepherd them all together at the same pace. And what typically happens, let's say we're in a middle school pre-algebra class and the current unit is on exponents, the teacher will give a lecture on exponents, then we'll go home, do some homework, the next morning we'll review the homework, then we'll get another lecture, homework, that'll continue for about 2 or 3 weeks, and then we get a test. And on that test, maybe I get a 75% Maybe you get a 90%, maybe you get a 95%. And even though that test has identified gaps in our knowledge, I didn't know 25% of the material. Even the A student, what was the 5% they didn't know? Even though we've identified those gaps, the whole class will then move on to the next subject, probably a more advanced subject that's going to build on those gaps. It might be logarithms or negative exponents. And that process continues, and you immediately start to realize how strange this is. I didn't know 25% of the more foundational thing, and now I'm being pushed to the more advanced thing. And this will continue for months, and it'll continue for years, all the way to at some point, I might be in an algebra class or trigonometry class, and I hit a wall. And it's not because algebra is fundamentally difficult, or because the student isn't bright. It's because I'm seeing an equation, and they're dealing with exponents, and that 30% that I didn't know is showing up. And then I start to disengage. And to appreciate how absurd that is, imagine if we did other things in our life that way. Say, home building. So we bring in the contractor, say, told we have 2 weeks to build the foundation, do what you can. So they do what they can. Maybe it rains, maybe some of the supplies don't show up. And 2 weeks later, the inspector comes, looks around, says, okay, the concrete's still wet right over there. That part's not quite up to code. I'll give it an 80%. Say, great, that's a C, let's build the first floor. Same thing. Yeah, we have 2 weeks, do what you can. Inspector shows up in 2 weeks, it's a 75%. Great, that's a D plus. Second floor, third floor. And all of a sudden, while you're building the third floor, that whole structure collapses. And if your reaction to that is the reaction that you typically have in education, or that a lot of folks have in education, you might say, maybe we had a bad contractor, or maybe we needed better inspection or more frequent inspection. But what was really broken was the process. We were artificially constraining how long we had to do something, pretty much ensuring a variable outcome. And we took the trouble of inspecting and identifying those gaps, but then we built right on top of it. So the idea of mastery learning is to do the exact opposite. Instead of artificially constraining when and how long, fixing when and how long you work on something, pretty much ensuring that variable outcome, the A, B, C, D, F, and do it the other way around. What's variable is when and how long a student actually has to work on something, and what's fixed is that they actually...
So that ended a little quickly there, but you know, one of the things he said was, what's variable is how long they have to do that. Now, I want to just highlight something here that was absolutely essential, I think, in what Khan had to say. Also, to notice, we are treating competency-based learning, which is the term that he used, mastery or mastery-based learning, and individualization, at least as defined by USDOE, as synonyms. So whether you're calling competency, mastery, or individualization, move ahead of the pace, it's the same thing. But to me, the heart of this whole video is when he said, when you artificially constrain time, when you say this thing's got to happen in this amount of time, you are pretty much ensuring variable outcomes. And I love the building example that he gave for two reasons. First of all, I'm building a house now, and I don't want a contractor to build on an 80% foundation. And secondly, because that house is being built in Texas and our soil here shifts a lot, I want to make sure the foundation is right. But what Khan said is we often just fix time and then we move ahead. The kids only have a percentage of it, and that process repeats and repeats and repeats until finally kids, metaphorically speaking, fall apart. Changing the model. It's not about seat time. It's about mastery. So I encourage all of you to go see the entirety of that video. Again, back just very quickly to Patrick and Sturgis. Again, these are the qualities, if you will, of competency-based learning. And they're talking about this is what it would look like, that students would advance upon demonstrated mastery, and we'd have these clear targets that would empower students, and that assessment is meaningful. But I'd like to, just because time is short for us today, I'd like to hit what I think are at least three necessary ingredients. These are the qualities, but let's talk about what you got to have on your shopping list. What is it that you've got to figure out how to put in place to have a chance to begin to pilot and do some work around competency-based mastery or individualized learning. Now, again, what I'm going to show you, it's not an exhaustive list. I didn't try to say everything, but I think there's really three things you've got to think about putting into place if you want to transition from the seat time model to the mastery model. The first one is this. you're going to have some type of competency-based model. That is, you're going to need to know what are the outcomes that you expect of each course. It sounds like something we kind of should have, but often we don't. Often daily what happens in our classrooms is driven by the textbook. And we talk about being driven by the standards, but are those standards written at a specific level of granularity that will guide all the outcomes of this course? And then there's a conversation about, do we expect kids to master all of these standards? Or is mastering a good solid majority enough? Now that question alone could be an entire webinar, but I just want to again hit here three elements that I think are essential. So one, you're going to have this competency model. You're going to have to know what are the outcomes for a given class or course? What is it that we expect kids to do and what level of proficiency do we want within that set of outcomes? The other thing you're probably going to have, and this is one that I think it's a matter of how far do you go, but I think schools are going to figure out how to have far more flexible scheduling. Because at the heart of the Patrick and Sturgis list of qualities, what it says is students advance upon demonstrated mastery. So, conceptually speaking, if it's the 27th of April, and as a principal, my former student Tammy is on the line, she gets an email from one of her teachers saying, Johnny just finished all of the outcomes of the course that he's in. We need to figure out how to move him to the next course. So if that's geometry, if I finish all the outcomes today, I'm done with geometry. I can go on to algebra two. We aren't used to making these mid-year course corrections, but if we're really gonna let kids move ahead at their own pace, we're gonna figure out our way to do that. And one of the things I see in some of the districts that are leading the way nationally is, at least in the high schools that are doing this, many kids are finishing their coursework and beginning joint classes with local community colleges, in some cases with kids graduating with either associate's degree or just a few breaths away from being done. So we're gonna need our competency model, we're gonna need our flexible scheduling, and another one that won't be easy to work on either is we're gonna need to have redefined teacher roles and responsibilities. This is going to change the way we work daily as teachers. Many of us are often used to being up in front of the class and delivering very much whole group stuff. And Khan talked about the fact that we often shepherd kids through these experiences that are fixed at time. But if we throw time out the window and really let kids move along at their own level of mastery, what that means is far less direct stuff. In fact, in the schools that are really doing this, what they report is there's very little whole class stuff. When there is, it's often just instructions about how the day or the week is going to flow. There is far more small group work and far more one-on-one type of work. Also, there's an element of this that scares many teachers because what they say is, oh my gosh, 30 kids moving individually. I'm going to have 30 kids on 30 different plans in 30 different places. The reality of it is it doesn't often end up like that. Often if I say, and I think about a high school in terms of about 1,000 kids, because the high school where I was administrator, that's how many kids we had. I had 1,000 kids and I have a teacher who's teaching geometry. She's not gonna have 30 kids in her room all in different places. They're gonna be kids randomly coming in and out. And there's gonna be clusters of kids moving together who are in similar places. We also know that we don't wanna individualize or personalize to the point that every kid's doing their own thing because conversations and interactions and peer tutoring, these are all great things. Learning is inherently social. So one of the dangers of individualization and personalization is we don't wanna go too far because we want to make sure the kids can still sit down and talk with others about what they're doing. But if we're going to do it, I think these are the essential parts. Have your model. Know what the outcomes are. Figure out how to make your scheduling and your resources flexible and prepare your teachers to have completely redefined roles and responsibilities that are going to look somewhat different. In fact, I have a blog I was just working on the other day where I was reflecting on what is really new about personalized learning, going back to that definition we started with. Is it differentiation? No, it's not. We've been talking about that for years. Is it student agency? Well, that term's new, but through formative assessment and other things, we've often talked about student agency. We just didn't label it that. The truly new thing in personalized learning is individualization, competency, mastery. And those things fundamentally call upon us to think about reinventing school as we know it. So once we understand the scale of this, it might scare us to death and we say we don't want to even do anything. But let's assume we say, okay, how would I begin that? I want to make a couple of recommendations. And the first recommendation is this. I think that all of this work must begin by teachers really building capacity around assessment. One of my colleagues and long-term associates is Rick Stiggins, and he's one of the most prolific authors in the United States on assessment. And Stiggins said, we don't give teachers a lot of assessment training. In fact, what we do to teachers is kind of like training doctors without helping them understand what medical tests to order and how to interpret the results. Teachers often don't get that much training on assessment. And if we are going to personalize and individualize, we're going to need to know assessment really well. In particular, for those of you in states that use an RTI or response to intervention or multi-tiered systems of support model, I think it's the progress monitoring piece that we're going to need critically. Because when we start individualizing and personalizing, we're going to be trying out all sorts of different approaches. And we're going to need to know through progress monitoring which approaches are working. And clearly, if kids are moving ahead on a mastery model, we're going to need to have the assessment skills necessary to measure their progress ahead on that model. So it's going to take a lot of assessment. I want to hold up a couple of resources here. Assessment is a large, large field. Sometimes when I say assessment, people think the state test. But I actually prefer to spend more of my time working and writing about the classroom level of formative assessment, stuff that's not about a grade, it's just information to teachers and students. And I want to hold up these two books. The book that you see on the left, Embedded Formative Assessment, is by a friend of mine, Dylan William. He and a gentleman named Paul Black did a meta-analysis in 1998, which is one of the most significant studies on formative assessment, showed huge impacts in learning when teachers can weave assessment into their daily practice. And that book, Embedded Formative Assessment, contains 53 different teaching strategies. And what I find is teachers want strategies. They want to know how to do it tomorrow or next week. And so it's a very user-friendly, practical book. On the other side there, we see a book by Jan Chapuis. She is a colleague of Dr. Stiggins, Rick Stiggins, at the Assessment Training Institute in Portland, Oregon. And Jan and Rick and the authors there have had a very unique focus on formative assessment. They've talked about formative assessment, but they specifically studied it about how does it impact kids. So that's one of the last big ideas we'd like to talk a little bit about today is if we switch to a mastery model, if we truly individualize, how is that going to impact kids? And I think what we can see is it may make some very positive changes because when you're on the traditional model, it's about tests and accountability. So often then assessment is seen as a punishment. If you move to a mastery model, what many schools say is our kids are no longer afraid of assessment. It's just information about where I am now and where I need to go next. And it's very much neutral to them. It doesn't have as many negative consequences. These are the five areas that William writes about in Embedded Formative Assessment. He said these are the five types of things that you should think about in relation to assessment. And I want to highlight a couple that relate to our topic of individualization. Take a look at the first one, clarifying and sharing learning intentions and criteria for success. There's building your mastery model. There is defining what the outcomes are of a given course and being prepared to communicate those to a kid. So by studying some of the strategies, I think you'll get some good ideas there. Also, you'll notice the fourth bullet down, activating students as owners of their own learning. We can call that student agency. They're getting involved as agents of their own learners, but also that's part and parcel with moving to an individualized model because it calls upon kids to get involved and to be part of the process here. Another work, and this is part from Jan Chapuis that I showed you on the screen there. She and her colleagues have written again profoundly about how does what we do in the name of assessment impact kids' motivation? Does it cause them to work harder in school or does it cause them to shut down? Does it build them up or put them down? And so what they did is they took formative assessment strategies, and they aligned it to a motivation framework from Roy Sadler from Australia. And what Sadler says is kids will be motivated, and kids can sustain motivation over time if they can always answer the following three questions. They need to be able to say, where am I going? Where am I now? And how can I close the gap between those two places? So what Jan Chapuis and the others did is, and I'm going to blow this up for you so you can see it in just a minute, but take a look at the citation on the side. She said, what we tried to do is focus on the student as the most influential decision maker in the classroom, where the kids are deciding to be involved in what's going on or to disengage from it. And what they said is formative assessment strategies have the power to help kids answer these questions. So when kids say, where am I going? If you have clear and understandable goals or learning targets, and you give them models to work towards, that helps kids answer that question. In terms of figuring out where am I now, if you give them regular descriptive feedback and teach them to self-assess and set goals, that helps them understand where they are now. And in terms of that final question, how do I close the gap between those two places? Designing lessons that focus on one particular aspect of quality at a time, teaching through using very focused revision, and engaging students by allowing them to self-reflect and calling upon them to keep track of and share their learning, that will help them see how they're working to close the gap. And again, Chapuis' book, which again is available in the slides there, is also full of strategies to say, how would you do each of these seven things that would help kids answer these three essential questions? And in answering those questions, drive a force of motivational information over time. So our time is growing short here. Hopefully I've given you a new definition and you understand how personalization works. You've thought about the scale or how significant it is when we talk about changing individualization, because it really is the new thing in personalized learning, and it really is the thing that will call upon us to change our schools the most. But if you're like me, when I started getting into some of this literature, you really said to yourself, oh my gosh, this is a lot of work. Is it worth it? Changing everything about teachers' roles and responsibilities, coming up with all these lists of skills that kids need to master, tracking them towards this, making ourselves more flexible, is it worth it? And so I want to share insights from or with you from a book that I read about a year ago that really changed the way I see things. And I read a lot for my job. I'm constantly reading books. And every now and then, I'd say about every 5 years, I come across a book that when I read it, I literally don't look at the world the same way when I'm over. And this is one that falls into that category. So if you haven't read this one, I hold it up as a really, really good read. It's called The End of Average, How We Succeed in a World That Values Sameness. And it's written by a Harvard professor, Todd Rose. Now, to be clear, Rose himself was a highly unsuccessful K-12 student. He didn't make it into Harvard till he was in graduate school and had really turned things around for himself academically. And what he says is, we in education rely upon information based on averages too much. What's the average score in a test? What's the standard deviation, which just talks about how the averages are spread out? What about the percentiles, which just talks about how you are on the scale of averages? We have so many words that are derivatives of averages that it speaks to how much we rely upon averages to explain what's going on. So let me tell you the story that Rose begins this book with. He begins with the story of the Air Force as jet planes began going online. So suddenly fighter jets or fighter planes were jets, and therefore were much, much, much faster. And for those of you that follow military history, you may know that in the worst day of aviation training in the history of our country, 17 pilots died in crashes in one day. That's huge. Think about it. 17 people died in training activities. So the Air Force began an investigation. What's going on? How can this be happening? And first of all, they said, well, maybe it's our training program. Maybe we're not training people as well as we should. Studied the programs, they audited them, they said, nope, seems like the training's pretty darn good. Well, maybe it's the pilots themselves. Maybe since we're not during draft time and we don't have all sorts of people to choose from, Maybe our pool is smaller and therefore we don't have as much talent. And they did an audit and they said, no, the men in the program now seem to be just as capable as the people that came before them. And finally, someone came up with an idea that a lot of people agreed had merit. Someone said, what if it's the cockpit? Because the cockpits of planes at this time had been laid out in the 1920s based upon averages then. And what people said was, well, maybe, you know, with more nutrition, maybe people are bigger now, and maybe the cockpits are not laid out in the right manner. And if you're flying a jet and you're going so fast, if it takes you a fraction of a second more to reach for control in a jet, that fraction of a second could be the difference between life and death. And so they commissioned a young lieutenant, his last name was Daniels, and they said, Daniels, we want you to measure over 4,000 airmen to help us determine the build of an average pilot so that we can build a cockpit to fit the average pilot. So Daniels took 10 different measurements on over 4,000 airmen. He was to figure out what the mean measurement was, another word for average, and ultimately define average as being within 15% on either side of that. So you've got the normal curve distribution and plus or minus a little bit at the top. So when Daniels did this work, he admitted later, he said, I wasn't sure that what we're doing was going to answer the question we had or solve our problem. So before he turned in his averages to his superiors, he did a little check. He said, let me figure out how many airmen are actually average on all 10 qualities. Now remember, he measured over 4,000 airmen. Most of you will be shocked to know that when he went back and compared the actual measurements to these averages that he determined, zero airmen fit all 10 measurements. So he started lowering the threshold. What if they're on 9 out of 10 or 8 out of 10 or 7 or 6? He went all the way down to 3 out of 10 qualities. And when he lowered his threshold to 3 out of 10 qualities, he found about 5% of the population met those qualities. So this young lieutenant had to walk in to a meeting with his superiors and say to them, gentlemen, there really is no such thing as an average pilot. So if we're trying to build a cockpit to fit the average pilot, we're actually building a cockpit that will fit nobody. At the end of the day, what Todd Rose wants us to understand through this example and others is, if you were talking about one quality, like average height or weight, averages work. We can talk about the mean, we can talk about standard deviation, we can talk about percentiles. He said, but if you're talking about anything that is more than one quality, anything that is complex, the averages probably are not going to show you what you think. In fact, let me show you what happens with the averages here. Here are two men who, when the 10 qualities were balanced mathematically, the formula that the Air Force was beginning to base the cockpit on would have said, these men are identical. And what Rose said is, if I'm going to take averages away from you, I've got to give something back to you. And what he says is, I think you need to think about complex things like body shape or intelligence as a jaggedness profile. And you see it reflected in the jagged shapes there of the sub-qualities or sub-tests. Some attendees are going to be higher in some factor, some students lower on another. He even has an example. If you go to his website or take a look for it, what you'll find is he has an example where he has two girls who've gotten the same IQ score, but the subtest of their IQ, they're higher in one area and lower in another. So what he says is, if you want to know about one quality, use your averages. If you want to know about something complex, you're going to have to look at it at a more granular level, and it's probably going to be more jagged. So at the end of the day, here's the question for us as educators. If the Air Force can't use averages to build a cockpit that's going to fit the physical attributes of the average pilot, how realistic is it for us to think that we're going to be able to build a standardized school program that's going to meet students' many and varied cognitive needs? And at the heart of this conversation, and Todd continues the book by talking about the history of education, and he makes what I think is the most clear and compassionate case for personalized learning. We're going to have to look at kids' jaggedness profiles. We're going to have to look at the context in which they operate and understand that it's not about averages and that we as human beings are all far more unique than averages can ever capture. And particularly in relation to individualization, take a look at this. Here's a picture that sort of represents our standard approach, the factory model. And what Rose is saying is we've got to mix it up. The factory model says, if you're 5 years old, you can begin this program. You spend 180 days there. If you get this grade or better, you move ahead. There's time driving the machine. And remember what Kahn said. If time is fixed, the outcomes will always be variable. Take a look at this, and I apologize. It's a screenshot that I took in a session with Todd. I'll try to interpret it some for you. This is a class where some content was taught and then a test was given. The colored lines that you see represent the students, and you won't be able to make it out, but there's a little circle where the bar is that occurs where the class exam was, and in that circle is a percentage. So if you see that sort of tan colored line at the bottom, what it says in the circle is 32. And what it means is the student who's represented by that line mastered 32% of the content. At the top, you see the green line, 76. The student represented by that line mastered 76% of the content when there was an exam given at a fixed time. But this class wasn't based on fixed time. It was a self-paced class. You see that in the corner. In other words, it was a class using individualized learning. They were adjusting for pace. Watch what happened. When given more time, all of the kids went to higher levels of performance. And take a look at the kid who was at the bottom. The kid that had 32% mastery when time was fixed, when given a little bit time, more time, actually went on to be the student that mastered the most content. And that circle is 98. All kids continue to rise. And for some kids, this is a fundamental game changer. And that's what we hear from school after school that's implementing this. Kids get more involved. They track their own learning, they see their own great growth, and they become very involved. Instead of that black and white picture of the factory model where things are very standardized, and did you notice there were no girls in the picture? We're trying to move to a world that's a bit more colorful and a bit more dynamic, and one that adjusts itself in terms of pace and approach to meet the needs of kids. And with that said, we'll get ready to wrap up here. I'm going to bring Jan back on so we can do some questions. Again, Renaissance Learning is sponsoring today. And we're working in the area, in two main areas. How do you reduce planning time so that people can do more differentiation for their kids? And how do you track all this data if you're doing mastery discussions? So, Jan, we have a few minutes here where we can take a couple of questions. Were there some that sort of rise or rose up to the top?
Sure. I'm going to go through these. We had several on just community and how to get this going. So we had from Oregon, from Iowa, there was a brief discussion going on between Linda and Marlene about competency. And it says that we say that we do this, we're making the discussion about the move, but it seems to require deep advocacy. So Jean, I'm forming a question for them. Where would you begin to build advocacy to make this move in a school district?
Again, I would refer to the INACOL site. They're very good, and there's a lot of reports there and a lot of examples here. I would say this is a major shift. So with a background in school leadership, what I would say is I don't want to make this shift without a public relations campaign that explains to people why we're changing the way we are functioning in our school and what's in it for their kids. Because let's face it, every parent went to school. That means that they think they know something about school, which they do, but it's based on their own experience. And when we as school leaders try to make school look like something that's very different from what they know, often there's going to be questions. So I would say it's going to begin with some impassioned cases. There's some great examples in some of the white papers from INACOL about kids who were not very successful and in very short time under an individualization approach became very successful and very vested in their own learning. I'd want to tell some of those stories. I'd want to point out how fixed time and our traditional model actually sets us up. Sal Kahn's got some great videos out there that go into greater detail, and there was more than we showed there. I think those messages begin the advocacy. The other thing that I hear from many experts in the field is, ideally, they would like to have an entire school working on this together. They'd love to have the whole district, but if they can start out with a school as a pilot, you've got to have enough people to sort of build that culture there. I'm a realist. I don't think that a school is going to move from, you know, a traditional model to an individualized model overnight. It's going to take time and it's going to take communication. But there's also some great stories out there to build the advocacy and build people's urgency about making such a fundamental shift.
We may just have time for one more, and then I want to make a couple of comments about how you can access all these questions, the chat, and the resources. But we have Miriam from Italy and Gail from Iowa who ask, is there a difference between project-based learning and competency-based?
And I would say yes. When you see the conversations about project-based learning, and of course performance tasks would come into that, that's a unique part of it. I see competency-based as a whole. So let me just use an example. Let's say geometry class. I may look at all of the specific skills of geometry. I may identify certain ones that I say, you got to know this one. You got to know it just stone cold to be granted mastery of geometry. Here's some others that are, flexible. We can get a certain percentage there. So we can go skill by skill by skill. But often what we see is people will list these skills. These are the outcomes the kids need to be able to do. And in addition to a skill by skill perspective, we also need there to be projects the kids work on. So that might turn into something like this. To receive a credit in our high school for a geometry class, here's a list of objectives you must master. Here's another list of objectives you must master a portion of these. And in addition to mastering at a computational and procedural level those objectives, you must also complete X number of performance task or project-based learning experiences, making sure that there's that deep application piece in there, that it's not just a computational procedural if you're in mathematics, or a DOK level one, lower level understanding of the content. So we see many conversations around project-based learning to make sure that it's deep, meaningful, and applied. Any more,
Thank
Jan?
You. We have several, but we're at the top of the hour, so I want to thank you so much, Gene. We worked together and I learned, we were together this morning reviewing this, and I learned even more today. I do want to thank Renaissance for allowing us to work with EdWeb on this and for sponsoring the webinar.
We hope you enjoyed this EdWeb podcast. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.